Eyewitness News. Be there as it happens.
City News.
It's 17:30 GMT. This is Eyewitness News on 97.3 City FM. I am Umaru Sanda Amadu. And tonight, I'm here with
Hawa Idrisu Mustafa.
And coming up over the next 90 minutes.
Good news. But what is refreshing is that she'll be brought down to face the sentence. No problem at all. Started the process, and with this judgment, that's going to speed up the process.
Former Maslock boss Sedina Tamaklu Ationu sentenced to 10 years in prison for stealing and causing financial loss to the state. But she's not in Ghana. How can the sentencing be enforced? Also coming up, unposted rotational nurses take to the streets to protest the hardship they are currently suffering. We'll be hearing from them. And later, on Eyewitness News, Public Utilities Regulatory Commission, PURC, orders board members of ECG to pay 5.8 million cedis to the state after the company failed to publish a Dumsor timetable among a host of other wrongs. Stay with 97.3 CTFM for more on this and many other stories on Eyewitness News. And in business,
ratings agency Fitch projects profit of banks to weaken due to new cash reserve requirement. That is a requirement by the Bank of Ghana.
That's in 50 minutes from the City Business Desk. Eyewitness News is live across Ghana on a host of affiliate stations, including this list that Hawa is going to share with us. Hawa.
In the Western region, we are live on Premier FM 100.5 in Takoradi, Sky Power 93.5 also in Takoradi, Beach FM 105.5 also in Takoradi, Bono region, Greener FM 95.9 in Sunyain, Ashanti region, Orange FM 107.9 in Kumasi, Eastern region, Wright FM 90.1 in Soumenya, Volta region, Holy FM 98.5 in Aplao, Northern region, Dasu FM 99.1 in Yendi, Upper East Word FM 88.3 in Zuarungu, and Upper West, we are live on Bugli Radio 88.6 in Wa.
And on YouTube, we are on CityTube. We are also on citynewsroom.com. The show is interactive. Join us on WhatsApp 0549-986-996, 0549-986-996. We start off from the courts, and today the verdict was that Sedina Ationu is to go to jail for 10 years, and she's supposed to do that in hard labor. She and one other person who has been given 5 years. It has to do with a loan agreement that was given at the time by the Micro and Small Loan Center, which she was heading in the Eswar John Mahama government. Our court correspondent is Hansen Ajiman, and he's in studio. Hansen, you're welcome to Eyewitness News.
Thank you, Sanda.
Give us a background to the case of the state.
So the case concerns activities that were undertaken by Maslock between the period of 2013 to 2016. Now, the issues primarily concerned misappropriations, as were alleged at the time, and also some alleged reckless or careless actions that were taken by the accused persons at that time that caused financial loss to the state. And also non-compliance with the procurement laws, as well as issues of money laundering. And so the specific facts of the case is that in one instance, the first accused person, who is a former Maslock boss, issued 500,000 Ghana cedis as loan to a microfinance company known as Obatampa. Now, the interest on that loan, as Obatampa later came to learn, was that they were supposed to pay 24% on that loan. They thought that it was on the high, and so the per their negotiations and engagements with Maslock, they were supposed to return the 500,000 cedis loan that had been given to them. Now, evidence as presented in court by the prosecution suggested that that 500,000 cedis was returned to Maslock, or to the CEO of Maslock then, Sedina Tamaklu. And even per the evidence, at a point in time, some 50,000 Ghana cedis as part of that money was given to the driver of the former CEO, who also testified in court that he gave that money to Madame Sedina Tamaklo. But there's no evidence on record to show that that money went into the account of Maslok. So there's some misaccounting there.
So and to, what's to, the to, case? So to simplify it, Sedina Tamaklo was heading Maslok, which is a state institution that gives loans to companies and individuals.
Yeah.
So Maslok gave 500,000 cedis to a micro small scale company, a micro finance company. They realized later that the interest was too high, and they said, "We are returning your money." So they returned the money. Did they return it through head driver?
They returned that money. How they returned that money is not a matter of evidence.
Okay.
But there's evidence that some 50,000 Ghana cedis at least was returned to the driver to be given to Madame Sedina. Okay. Again, there's evidence that Madame Sedina wrote to the microfinance that they have received the 500,000 cedis that have been returned. And so on record, that money was returned to Maslok.
But the money could not be found.
But the money could not be found and was not in the book of Maslok.
So the state is saying that to the extent that the money has been returned but is not in the books of Maslok, she stole the money.
You misappropriated it.
So the specific charge was stealing. So she stole the money. She started a defense in the beginning before disappearing,
Yes, she did. So in as a result of that, now she left the process, the hearing of the case at a point. And so the court did not have the benefit of her entire defense. And so the court relied on her caution statement. And what she said during cross-examination of the key witnesses through her lawyers. And her one of the defense she mounted essentially was that the signature as was contained in some of
the correspondence
regarding to the money being returned, she has no idea of it, and that the signature of it, she doesn't recall ever signing that signature, but it looks like a signature.
So she's denying telling the company that I've received your money.
She's denying, but she's also acknowledging that the signature that is there looks like her signature. Okay. That is what she said to have said in her caution statement.
But she hasn't admitted that the money was paid back, has she?
Well, there's a letter, so the said letter that admits that the money has been received has her signature on it. And that is the fact the court is working with.
Okay.
In her caution statement and in her cross-examination, she sought to indicate that, yes, I recognize the signature as mine, but I don't remember signing the same. But because she did not stay throughout for the entire duration of the trial, when her time was ripe to open her defense, she was not available to give any explanation as to why it is so.
So the money is missing. She's also missing. Where is she?
Well, from what we've been told, it appears she's in the United States. The Attorney General's Department has indicated to us that they are putting in place measures to make sure that she should be extradited into the country. The judge who presided over the case, Justice Efia Sewasaribuchi, a Court of Appeal judge sitting as an additional High Court judge, she raised concern as to why, since 2022, when she decided not to return, and in 2023, when a ruling was given for the case to be done in absentia, why the state didn't actively take steps to extradite her into the country. Because if you look at the charges and you look at the evidence as has been presented, it appears, and as determined by the court, that she was the beneficiary of the scheme. And she has not been present. And so it was a difficult situation for the judge, considering the fact that the second accused person, in terms of monetary benefit, you couldn't directly link him to some great benefit with respect to the scheme.
Okay.
Because per the evidence, he indicated that he was given 20,000 CDs, and that 20,000 CDs was given as a gift. But even on that level, the judge said the actions that he took was reckless to a certain extent as a public official and as a civil servant, but was concerned why the state didn't take a decision to extradite Madame Sedina.
Who is this second person you're talking about?
This is Daniel Azim. He was the chief operating officer of Maslock at the time the incident took place.
He did not get 10 years.
He got 5 years. In his defense to this particular charge of stealing, the case against him was that he issued 23 memos that caused the basis for the monies to be released. And he indicated that Maslock has been politicized in a certain way that you are, one way or the other, stopped from acting contrary to orders that you've received from your superior. And that he didn't act in a certain way because he was afraid of losing his job. But this defense, as he made in court, was not one that the court will agree with, because according to the judge, it is stated in case law that the defense of yielding to superior orders often than not to apply as a defense when it comes to people relating to the armed forces. And when it comes to civilians, it will only rather be a mitigating matter, meaning that you can only rely on it to aid the court to reduce the sentence. The court found out that for you to have consistently issued 23 memos for monies to be released for things that were not done. This brings me to one of the other charges, that about 1.8 million Ghana cedis was dispersed. This 1.8 million Ghana cedis was dispersed to be used for a sensitization exercise. This sensitization exercise, 853,000 persons were supposed to be beneficiaries, of which every person was supposed to get 20 cedis. But it ended up that they only gave 1,300 Ghana cedis to the beneficiaries. The remainder of that money, as was proven by the state in court, was actually misappropriated by the first accused person with the help of the second accused person. And the court indicated that it was important to hand down a deterrent punishment to both the first accused person and the second accused person, who is a civil servant, because without his actions, which in any way are illegal and reckless, considering the duty the position he held and the mandate that he was supposed to implement, if he had done his work appropriately, this amount of money that we are talking about would not have been appropriated.
So Mr. Azim was in court himself.
He was in court himself.
So he's been taken away.
Yes. At the time we were leaving, he was still in the courtroom. Usually what happens is that when the sentence is handed, some documents will have to be done, preparations will have to be made for you for the appropriate prison that you'll be spending the duration of the sentence. But per my knowledge of the system, by this time he should have been transported either to a police custody awaiting to be transported to the prison or directly to the prison.
But Sedina is not in the country. Did she run away or she had permission to leave?
So in 2021, she requested, as part of her bail conditions, her passport was seized by the court. She asked for her passport for a medical checkup. And she requested it at the time the court was about to go on vacation. And the state did not oppose this request. So the court then agreed for her to go for this checkup and then adjourned the case to the next start of the legal year. Yeah. So usually the court will go on break in July and then will return somewhere in September. And so it was adjourned to after September.
And she never came back.
She never came back. And so the state went ahead to file an application for her to be tried in absentia, meaning that the trial will go on without her absence, in her absence. And so for the in January 2023, the court finally took a decision to try her in absentia. And since then, the case has been ongoing without her. And the state will now have to rely on its international partners if they can get her back into the country.
Thank you, Hansen. Let's listen to Deputy Attorney General Fretia Yeboah. He was in court and is excited by the judgment and says that they are going to take steps to bring Sedina Tamaklo home to be sentenced or to go to prison. Listen to him.
Good news, but what is refreshing is that she'll be brought down to face the sentence. No problem at all.
Has the processes begun already or you're not going to
begin? We've started the process, and with this judgment, that's going to speed up the process. And you know, Ghana, we have various laws. You can just stay away. But so far as you have laws relating to how you can extradite it from one country to Ghana, in case there's a judgment against like this one, rest assured that should be brought down to face justice.
We know that when it comes to extradition, it deals more with the treaty that you have with the country the person is residing in. Can you throw some more light when it comes to the processes with respect to US and Ghana, where she is?
I may not throw us so much for you, but we have the MLA, Mutual Legal Assistance, US, we have that treaty with them. So very soon, you hear about the results. So just rest assured and keep monitoring the space.
But has the state been not been proactive with this? The judge appeared not happy that you had to wait all this while.
I think the state attorneys are here. In the course of the trial, they made it known to the court that the issue of extradition may be tackled. But the preoccupation was to make sure the matter proceeded to finality. And today, we've come to that stage. And so we're going to take that next step. When it comes to extradition, sometimes you start and you have some kind of problems, blocks. The person may choose to appeal and all manner of things. But this is the situation where we have final judgment. It's not as if you are being brought here to be tried, where you can raise all the defense out there that maybe they are going, they are persecuting or whatever, but it's a judgment. And so that's why I said, you hold on. Very soon, she will be brought down to Ghana to face justice.
What would you say to those who say Mr. Azeem has been treated unfairly? I mean, from the traces of money, it's just 20,000 cedis that he received, and that was even a gift.
It matters not. It can be one cedi. Was it properly received? This one is a form of advice and caution to all public office holders that when it comes to monetary matters, you must be very, very careful. You may want to say you receive only 20,000 Ghana cedis as a gift. Were you supposed to receive that money? What was that money meant for? We're the one who issued the vouchers, as the court said. So this judgment, I recommend that those of us in public office must procure copies and then read so that we know that our responsibilities. Because today, you may think that you've not been caught. When you are caught, definitely the law will deal with you as we've had it today.
In fact, prosecution was advocating for maximum punishment in relation to the sentencing. If you look at the sentencing that was handed down by the court, are you satisfied with that?
10 years is reasonable in the circumstance. I'm not going to inquire about it for now, but we'll take the full judgment and read. But 10 years is something that's reasonable in the circumstance. But if need be, that there's a need for an enhancement, why not? But at the moment, from what we've listened to and what we've learned from the judgment, 10 years is reasonable. And the other accused person also had 5 years cumulatively. So let's see what happens.
The state has been advised to issue for future proceedings. How is the state taking this advice?
We are going to follow it up. Any property that the first accused person has within the jurisdiction or outside the jurisdiction, if you get hold of it, we are going to pursue that property and get the money for the state.
By way of clarity, if the court says the judgment should be should take place concurrently, does that apply to the fines?
No, the fines are separate. And if you listen to the judge, some of them, he had sentences and a fine. So it means that the fines are in addition to the sentences. So we'll look at it carefully and they will be able to address you on the specifics.
So that's Deputy Attorney General Alfred Tion Yeboah speaking to City News' Hansen Ajiman. City News' Hansen Ajiman is still in studio. He's our court correspondent. Hansen, so aside the sentencing of Sedina Tamaklo and one other, what other big thing has been happening in the courts?
So the issue with respect to the EC's biometric voter registration kit equipment that are missing and have become subject of political controversy, particularly the laptops was a matter that came up in court, and the facts as we've picked up suggest that four persons have been arraigned. They have since been remanded into custody, and the case is expected to be called on May 12th. But three out of these four persons are staff members of the Electoral Commission. One is a Libra. Two, and another is a security officer. And the third person is a database administrator, all of the Electoral Commission. And then there's a fourth person who is a student. So out of the four people, one is not a staff of the Electoral Commission. What we've also learned is that the incident happened on or around March 9, 2024. Because according to the facts as read in court, the Electoral Commission instructed some of its casual workers together with some of the security officers to move some materials from their old office at Ridge to one of its warehouses at Spintex. And this instruction was given to them. So they started the movement of the equipment on March 9, 2024. At this point, the second accused person and the third accused person decided to take some printers, and they ended up taking those printers as well as some other equipment, including the laptops. Most of these equipment or items, as have been revealed in court, are related to the biometric voter registration kit. Now, the biometric voter registration kit is an entire kit on its own. So it has a computer, which is a laptop, it has a printer, it has a scanner, and it has a biometric device. And so this is different from the biometric verification device that is used on election day. This is the fact as we've attained from the court so far.
So have they been brought before court and formally charged, or you just saw the papers as have been presented to the court?
So they've been brought to court
physically,
has been formally charged. They've pleaded not guilty. The three staff of the commission, they've been charged with counts of stealing and conspiracy to steal, while the student, who is the fourth accused person, has been charged with dishonestly receiving.
Okay. Thank you so much. Hansen Ajiman is our court correspondent. This is Eyewitness News on 97.3 City FM. If you want details, go to our website, citynewsroom.com.
Eyewitness News. Be there as it happens.
Let your voice be heard on Eyewitness News on Facebook at facebook.com/city973, Twitter at twitter.com/city973, and Instagram at instagram.com/city973 with the hashtag Eyewitness News.
You're welcome back. The Public Utilities Workers Union (PUU) has described as abuse of power the actions of the Ashanti Regional Minister to cause the arrest of the Ashanti West manager of the ECG, Engineer Mark Asumeni Riafe. The minister, Simon Osemensa, is reported to have caused the arrest of Engineer Riafe following the disconnection of power to the Kumasi Technical University. This action of the ECG task force allegedly did not go down well with the minister, who subsequently directed the police to invite the ECG manager for questioning. According to PUU General Secretary Michael Edumata Nyantechi, the ECG manager was detained for several hours, a day after he honored the invitation of the police.
There was a task force from the national level that went to Kumasi to be an extension. And as part of the in connection with revenue mobilization, and Kumasi Technical University is owing quite a huge sum. So the task force which conducted the Kumasi Technical University for non-payment of payments. And when the information got to the regional minister, he called the Ashanti general manager of ECG, Engineer Riafe, and directed that they should reconnect the power to the institution. And Engineer Riafe explained that the task force that came was not from Ashanti region, and he doesn't have control over the activities of the parties. Now, it looks like the explanation did not go well with the regional minister. So he threatened that if the general manager did not allow his people to reconnect the power, then he will report the matter to the police. So in the night, the police called the general manager to report at the police station. So the following morning, he went to the police station. And when he got there, the police indicated they were investigating a complaint against him for causing public unrest. And then he was made to write a statement and then granted himself the condition. We say that this is most unfortunate, because this is a legitimate work that is being carried out by the city. And even if this was not by the Ashanti regional team, we intend making a statement on this in the public domain and then acknowledging that such act of abuse of power should not be tolerated within the body politic.
That was the General Secretary of the Public Utilities Workers Union, Michael Edumata Nyantechi. Three pre-tertiary teacher unions are bemoaning the slow pace of negotiations with the government concerning their conditions of service. The unions include NAT, NAGRAT and the CCT. They laid down their tools on March 20 this year. The groups called off the strike on April 2 after the NLC obtained an interim injunction to halt the industrial action, coupled with government assurance to deal with their concerns. In an interview with City News, however, the General Secretary of NAT, Thomas Musa, voiced dissatisfaction with the government approach to the negotiations, deeming it as indicative of bad faith.
They had severally made promises to us that, look, the moment we call off the strike, they will table whatever they have, to the extent of telling us that they've gone to the Jubilee House, they've obtained mandates and all that. You won't believe it. From the 2nd of April up to yesterday, the 15th of April, the government side, they have not tabled anything. They don't have anything on the table. And that constitutes bad faith. Because when you are engaging, you need to put something on the table in response to what the other party has done. That is what we call social dialogue. But when you come to the table, you have nothing there, and it is what your party has put on the table. That is what becomes the agenda and all that. You don't have anything to table. And you always come and complain, you come with lamentations and all that. We think that is not the way to go. Given the circumstances and the events unfolding, we think that government is not committed to our cause. And we need to sound alarm bells that should anything happen, the teacher unions cannot be blamed.
That was the General Secretary of NAT, Thomas Musa.
Let's talk about some energy-related matters now and the political connection to same. The National Democratic Congress branch in the Ashanti region has some questions to the president in relation to the Ameri power plant, which is being moved from the Western region to the Ashanti region. Exactly what these questions are, Abbas Nuruddin is Ashanti Regional Communications Officer of the NDC. He's joining us on the line. Sir, you're welcome to Eyewitness News.
Thank you very much for having me, Sanda.
They are bringing you power plant in your region, in your capital city, Kumasi. You should be celebrating, you know, standing by the road and welcoming the president to come and do the commissioning. And yet, you have issue. What's the matter?
Well, in principle, we have no issue with the relocation of that Mary to Kumasi. You know, Kumasi is the economic nerve center of Ghana. So any move to ensure sustainable power supply is welcome. However, there are some serious questions that are begging for answers. There is a deliberate attempt by this Akufo-Addo government to more or less obliterate the legacies of John Mahama in the energy sector. And those are the issues we had a press conference today to raise. First and foremost, why the renaming of the Ameri power plant to K1TPP? Why? Does the mere renaming of the power plant from Ameri to KPP resolve the dues that is currently presently ongoing in Ghana? Secondly, why is government spending hard-earned resources or scarce resources of this country to recommission a plant that was commissioned in 2015. Why? Is it intended to create a false sense of performance in the minds of the people? The last question is, why on earth is government claiming that it has used $35 million in relocating the plant from Takoradi to Kumasi? Sandra, the more questions we ask, the more confused we become. You know, the Akufo-Addo government has borrowed so much since 2017 with very little to show. So the government seemed to have adopted a strategy of more or less trying to take credit for most of the things President Mahama did, especially in the Ashanti region. Not long ago, the government sought to claim ownership of the Kumasi Airport Phase 2, which is a John Mahama project. Now they are changing the name Ameri to K1TPP, whatever that means. But we want the whole world to know, especially those in the Ashanti region, that when Dumso was destroying their businesses, when, as a result of the incompetence of this government, Dumso was thrust upon us, it was the towering interventions of John Dramani Mahama in the energy sector that is saving the situation. And we want to, based on this, to call on the entire people in the Ashanti region to keep faith with John Mahama in the upcoming election, since he holds the key to the economic development of this country.
So your difficulty is not about the transfer, it is about the cost and the renaming. What if the president does not rename it tomorrow? It remains Ameri.
Oh, they have already given indication. They have already outdoored the new name that is going to be given to the plant. And that is the source of our worry, that there seems to be a certain grand agenda to more or less delink the Ameri power plant, which is one of the many interventions of the S.Y. Mahama administration to solve Dumso, to delink DM's name and create the impression that it is something new that the Akufo-Addo government has done to resolve Dumso. That is what we are against. And come tomorrow, Sander, you will most likely see a lot of well-meaning Ghanaians, especially those from the Ashanti region, staging a protest at the location of where the recommissioning will happen to register their displeasure about the unnecessary pomp and pageantry that this government is seeking to use to recommission a plant that was commissioned in 2015.
So you're going to lead that demonstration tomorrow as a party?
Well, I will not give details for now, but you will most likely see a spontaneous reaction from a section of the inhabitants of the Ashanti region who are very angry, who are very dissatisfied by the attempt by the president to appropriate to himself projects that preceded his government. You would most likely see something like that.
Thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you very much for your time, Sander. It's always a pleasure speaking to you.
I appreciate that. That's Abbas Nuruddin. He's the Ashanti Regional Communications Officer of the NDC. This is Eyewitness News on 97.3 CTFM. We are coming to you from our studios in Adabraka in Accra. Talking about the power sector, the Public Utilities Regulatory Commission has issued a statement. We'll talk about that later. But before then, Hawa has some other stories.
Police at Akwadum in the Eastern Region are investigating the death of a 20-year-old welding apprentice, Felix Ayete, at Akwadum near the chief's palace. Felix Ayete is said to have been electrocuted at his workplace, but the circumstances leading to his electrocution is readily not known. The young man, who was rushed to the Ifijasi St. Joseph Hospital in Goforidua, was pronounced dead on arrival, and his body was subsequently deposited at the hospital's morgue for autopsy and preservation. The new Drabin North Municipal Deputy Director of NADMO, Kankamchu Messi, has been speaking to City News on the incident.
Around 10 a.m., we received a call from Akwadum Police Station that there has been an incident. A young man, age 20, named Felix Ayete, who is an apprentice, a welding apprentice, has been electrocuted at Akwadum near the chief's house. So we had to mobilize ourselves and get to the scene to take our assessment. But when we got there, the Akwedum police officers has already been there, and the body has been moved to the mortuary. That is the St. Joseph's mortuary at Efujuase. So we had to follow up to the Efujuase police station to take details of the boy, as indicated in the report.
That was a new job in North Municipal Deputy Director of NADMO, Kankam Chumisi.
The nurses who went to school finished and have not been posted were on the street today. It was raining, but they decided to go on the streets to demonstrate. So they are called Rotational Nurses and Midwives Association. That's the name of the group. Their president is Amebele Kwame Jr. He's the national president. He's joined us on the line. Mr. Kwame Jr., welcome to Eyewitness News.
Thank you, sir.
Tell us your story. Why you decided to go on the rains today to demonstrate? What could have been driving you out of your homes?
All right. Thank you. And a very good evening to your service listeners and viewers. So we are rotational nurses and midwives, just as you mentioned. And if we are talking about rotational nurses, we are talking about the interns, the national service personnel, those who are nurses and midwives and under the Ministry of Health. So we were posted to do our national service under the Ministry of Health in July 2023. And as it stands, we are 9 months into our national service, and our monthly allowances has not been paid to us, not even a city. This has been a phenomenal issue that our past seniors who completed their national service before we came also experienced the same issue. So when we started our national service, we thought it wise to write to the ministry to inform them that we are going to financial strains. The problems on the ground are difficult. Transporting ourselves to work, feeding, accommodation issues. So they should respond to us and give us, pay us our allowances. That letter was not responded to. We served notice of reminders, but were not responded to. We released a press statement, but ministry did not respond to us. So we had a discussion among our members, and they decided to the streets to show our displeasure towards the government. And so this morning, we went through all the procedures, and this morning we got it. Fortunately, unfortunately for us, the rain started to fall. And that couldn't prevent us, because with all the problems that I said, that shouldn't prevent us from fulfilling our mission today. So we, with the mission today, is to present the petition to the Minister of Health, Minister of Finance, and then the Parliament of Ghana. And all we are calling for is an urgent attention to our situation. We have been working for 9 months without allowance. These are allowances, not salaries. A very low amount, of course. I know you might like to ask, but it's just 870 Ghana cedis per month, and we are not paid. And when we are asking for what we deserve, we are being ignored. We feel neglected by the ministry, and we are calling on them to actually respond to us as soon as possible. So submitting the letter to them today, we went in the range to show that, yes, all the concerns that they've received earlier through the letters that we submitted to their offices are real, and even the rain cannot prevent us from displaying that to them.
This is an annual affair, isn't it, Kwame, that yes, seniors who finish school never get posted for a long time. What exactly is the problem? What has been causing this? Do you know?
I don't know. You know, the situation has not been explained. And that is our petition to the parliament, to invite both Ministry of Finance and Ministry of Health. Because when we visit Ministry of Health, you know, we don't have any issue with Ministry of Finance. We are under Ministry of Health. They tell you this. Today, in circumstance, when we presented our petition to the Director HR of Ministry of Health, and then the PRO of Ministry of Health, we asked them why the delay. The PRO of the Ministry of Health told us that they have done their part by submitting our details to Ministry of Finance to release our clearance so as we can be paid or posted to work as permanent staff. If you go to Ministry of Finance, we went there and we asked them what PRO has said, PRO of the Ministry of Health has said, if he can confirm that to us, he wasn't able to confirm. So you can see there are no communications. He it looks like there are no plans as to how they employ nurses. There are no plans. The people or the nurses have to put pressure on the government to alert them to do what they are supposed to do. And even with the payment of allowances, we have to put pressure. Our seniors have to fight, threaten a demonstration before their concerns were actually addressed. And they have to finish their national service 3 months after, stay at home 3 months after, before their service allowances were paid to them, which is not the case. It's a monthly allowance. It's not an ex gratia. So why should they be finishing their service? And the situation on that too is that when they finish their service, it is not everybody that is paid. Some have been paid less amount than their others. What they deserve are not given to them. So they just pay something and then they say they paid a rotation allowances. And that is why we are standing for allowances to be paid now. We need our money to live on.
How many batches before you are yet to be posted? Do you know?
So before us are two batches. The 2020 batch, 2021. We are 2022 batch, which will finish our national service in just 2 months' time. So in 2 months, we are going to add up to the backlog of two badges. That is making it three. And even after us, we have one badge at home who has already passed their license. So actually, there are four badges of nurses at home who have qualified. But just two of them have passed through the national service and are waiting posting. We will join the two to make it three in the next coming 2 months.
Which means that you should expect that the first two would be dealt with before it gets to your turn. So it means you have to exercise some more restraint and patience, don't you think?
So as we speak today, we are not talking about, our focus is not much about employment. We are working for the government actively, and that is our national service. And we are calling for a 9 month allowance. And one thing is, we are doing the national service to acquire skills. So why do we finish the national service and go and sit home for 3 years, 4 years before they employ us into service? If we are acquiring the skills and to go and stay home and the skills to fade out before they employ us back and come and train us on the job again, then there is no need to have the national service access. So what we are calling for is our money, and we are demanding that the moment we are done with our national service, see, the number we are talking about, staying at home, I don't have the accurate figures, but for my badge that is doing national service, it's 12,000. If you look at the loopholes in the healthcare system, if you post 12,000 times three nurses, times three of 12,000, there will still be, there will still be enough spaces to fill in the healthcare system. If you visit the wards, the staff to patient ratio is very low. They need nurses. But they are using the student nurses who are doing their clinicals and then we, the rotation nurses, to fill those loopholes, which it's not supposed to be. So the backlog of nurses at home can actually be curbed off if they are employed right after their national service.
Very well. Thank you so much. Are you going to go back to the streets again anytime soon?
So, actually, like I informed you, we released the press and they didn't respond to us. And we had an engagement with our members. Our members decided we go on a demonstration and present a petition to them. So, as it stands, our members have been addressed on whatever we've done so far, and the next line of action will be decided by the membership.
Thank you for speaking to us. That's Amebile Kwame Jr. He's national president of the Rotational Nurses and Midwives Association. They went on the street today to demonstrate. This is Eyewitness News on 97.3 CTFM. How are?
The flag bearer of the opposition National Democratic Congress, John Dramani Mahama, has criticized the Akufo-Addo government's launch of the performance tracker. Mahama described the projects listed in the tracker as mere fantasies that do not deserve commendation. The performance tracker is a new application launched by the government aimed at providing what it says is real-time information on the performance of ministries, departments, and agencies. Speaking during his Building the Ghana We Want tour in Nalarugo in the Northeast region, Mr. Mahama contrasted the performance tracker with the NDC's renowned Green Book, suggesting that the tracker is not a true reflection of the government's efforts.
You don't have to be sorry. They didn't deceive you alone. They deceived the whole of Ghana. So it's not you alone. So don't worry, you know. They packaged themselves nicely, made all kinds of promises, and today all those promises are broken. They've come with something they call a performance tracker, and they are retracting some of the things. They say 67 were put in error, and the performance tracker has things that district assembly should be doing. Toilet. We built a toilet here. We built a toilet there. You know. When we published our green book was evidence-based. And every single thing you see in the green book exists, and we have done it here in Ghana. They can go and take the green book. I challenge the media, go and take the green book and show me one project in the green book that does not exist. We didn't have to retract anything. They found it was solid. So they came and said that, oh, we went to Dubai and took pictures. University of Ghana Medical Center. They said it's a hospital in Dubai. Went and took the pictures and came and put it in the green book. Today, when they are sick, they go to the University of Ghana Medical Center for treatment.
Flag bearer of the NDC, John Dramani Mahama. The National Food Suppliers Association of Ghana is not enthused about a promise by former President John Dramani Mahama to cancel the use of the National Food Buffer Store Company for the distribution of food to senior high schools. The NDC flag bearer, during his Building the Ghana We Want tour in the Northeast region, said he will ensure that feeding grants are channeled through the heads of SHSs to procure food items for students. But spokesperson for the food suppliers, Kweku Amedume, in an interview with City News, says there should rather be more investment to the buffer stock company to improve its efficiency.
Those times when suppliers were not under buffer stock and were still dealing with the headmasters, there were times you supply food stamps to headmaster and as you're expecting money, another day you would go, they would tell you the headmaster has been transferred and there's no proper recording or documents pertaining to the delivery have made to the headmaster. And so you lose your money. As I speak with you, there are lots of money locked up with headmaster for a reason that those headmasters have been transferred or are gone on retirement, that they don't have proper records to show that the delivery has been made to those. You see, all we need is capacity building for buffer stock. Buffer stock has warehouses across all the farming communities. In fact, with silos, buffer stock can be able to hold food and buy the food and keep. And delivery will be going on efficiently. It is the money that is not available that is what is making the free SHS suffer. It will not help we, the suppliers, because whatever you look at it, the food will be procured from us. If you're asking the headmaster to procure, the headmaster cannot be able, given his burdensome responsibility, he cannot be able to go to the market to procure the food. He will rely on the suppliers.
Kweku Amedume speaks for the Food Suppliers Association of Ghana. The Coalition of Domestic Election Observers, CODEO, is calling on the NDC to prove how the missing biometric verification devices can corrupt the electoral process. This follows the NDC's consistent lamentation on the alleged missing biometric verification devices and consequently called for an independent probe into the matter. In an interview with City News, the national coordinator of CODEO, Albert Kofi Ahin, explained that an independent probe into the missing devices will allay fears of Ghanaians ahead of the elections.
Definitely, once these issues are raised, it will really disturb a little bit the Ghanaians who are at the background listening, and definitely it will shake up their faith in the commission a little. Like in all institutions, the theft may not have been detected earlier by the EC. I'm sure they may not have known that some of these things were missing even until I think the NDC brought it to their attention. So my advice is that they should try and prove to the EC that they can use those machines to corrupt the system. And I think every Ghanaian will be interested to know that. How can the missing computers be used to corrupt the system? That has to be proved. Because it will then, you know, allay or, you know, cool tempers. We need to be very careful to really listen. And if there's any probe to be done, any investigation to be done, it has to be done immediately to allay the fears of everybody in this country.
National Coordinator of Domestic Coalition of Domestic Election Observers, Albert Kofi Ahin.
Eyewitness News. Be there as it happens.
Get the details. Every significant financial transaction, every market movement, and all the policies that affect your business. City Business News. Be informed.
Time now for City Business News and Eyewitness News, brought to you by GCB Bank PLC. GCB Personal Loan, make that big move and dream a reality. My name is Hawa Idrisu Mustafa. Details of our stories now. The profitability of Ghanaian banks in the coming weeks is expected to weaken following the Bank of Ghana's recent decision to tie cash reserve ratio requirement to loans or deposits ratios. This is according to ratings agency Fitch. The move, aimed at boosting bank lending, will raise CRR requirement for banks with low LDRs. However, Fitch Ratings anticipate that banks would choose to tolerate the higher CRR requirement rather than significantly increase lending, citing Ghana's challenging macroeconomic conditions. Reacting to Fitch's report, banking consultant Dr. Richmond Etiahene affirms the repercussion of this new policy by the central bank.
At least central banks should have taken into consideration the rising non-performing and at the same time the structured bonds. Other than that, basically, a time will come, especially the indigenous banks. Indigenous banks, some of them will be out of business, especially in the IMF document. IMF is encouraging mergers, acquisition and takeovers. If you cannot meet the capital requirement, as they recently appointed an advisor for one of the banks, if you are not able to meet your capital reserves, per capital requirement, then somebody would have to come in and take it over. So if we don't adopt proactive strategy to preserve the domestic banks, if we don't take care, it will be like the mining sector, where once upon a time we had the gold fields. We have Dunkwa gold fields, we have these gold fields, but currently all the mining sectors are in the foreign hands. To ensure that at least the domestic banks are well protected from this, if we don't take care, we are making them vulnerable to be taken over by the banks that are ready to come into the system.
That was banking consultant Dr. Richmond Etiahene. A recent regression analysis conducted by the Institute for Energy Security has revealed a sharp surge in liquefied petroleum gas LPG prices across the country over the last 4 years. According to the report, the ex-pump price per kilogram of LPG has more than doubled from January 2020 to December 2023. Amidst the soaring prices, IES analysis identifies a concerning trend of declining consumption. Executive Director of IES, Nana Amoyesi VII, in an interview with City Business News, stressed the need to reverse the regression in LPG consumption.
And any factor that contributed to the decline in the volume of consumption, price played a significant role. And that 15% thereabouts of the decline in consumption can be attributed to the rising prices of LPG. And it's important that we reverse this decline in consumption because it goes against government's own target to attain 50% of LPG penetration in the country and also as part of its national determined contribution to dealing with climate change impact.
That was the executive director of the Institute for Energy Security, Nana Amoyesi VII. Meanwhile, the LPG Marketing Companies Association of Ghana is demanding the withdrawal of the tax on the pump price of liquefied petroleum gas. According to them, the decision directly impacts consumers and contradicts previous explanations for removing price stabilization and recovery levies. Gabriel Kumi is the vice president of the LPG Marketers Association of Ghana.
This is the highest ever single tax that has ever been placed on the product. It's a tax of about 1 to 20 pesos per kilo. And that has really shot up the pump price of LPG. In fact, this is a very dangerous tax in the sense that the tax is dollar denominated. What that simply means is that this tax is subject to the bullying of the dollar. What that further means is that anytime the dollar gains strength, anytime your city weakens, the tax will go up. So the 120 pesos we are seeing today is not the end of it. It's going to go up because obviously our city has not been too well against the dollar. So anytime your city weakens, expect to pay more for LPG. Before the 1st of April, we were buying LPG at about 14 cedis per kilo. With the introduction of that tax, the price of LPG moved from 14 cedis per kilo to 15 cedis, 20 pesos per kilo.
Gabriel Kumi is Vice President of the LPG Marketers Association of Ghana. The Association of Oil Marketing Companies is demanding clarity from the NPA over some variables in the new LPG price build-up. The association says it was not consulted prior to the inclusion of the cylinder investment margin and the bottling plant margin of LPG in the price build-up. In a statement, the OMC has maintained that, for the sake of transparency, they would appreciate a clear explanation on the purpose behind these margins and their management. Away from that, government says it remains committed to making Ghana a competitive player in the regional and global automotive industry by leveraging Germany's expertise and technology in the automotive sector. It is thus pushing to attract investment from Germany to bolster the implementation of Ghana's automotive policy to enhance local production and assembling of vehicles. This, it says, will also stimulate economic growth and create employment opportunities through strategic partnerships with international investors. A deputy trade and industry minister, Nana Dokoa Isiama Eje, has been speaking to the media after the second Ghana-Germany Business Council meeting in Accra.
Primarily, the main focus was more on the automotive industry and how to be able to fully complete the implementation and expand the automotive industry, including the component manufacturing and other things, which will prevent the excessive importation of all the component parts that they would need to be able to manufacture here. So for the various issues that they raise, some to do with their what they are happy about and some to do with some of the challenges they face, we're happy to be in the same room with some of the regulatory agencies' heads, and they were able to address it. And we're hoping that moving here, it doesn't end here. We are going to follow through and ensure that they get all the policy incentives that attracted them to get in here. And
Nana Dokoa Isiama Eje is a deputy trade and industry minister. Players within the housing industry are being urged to adopt the usage of prefabricated concrete component, otherwise known as precast concrete, in construction and in the bid to maximize productivity. Speakers at the International Concrete Conference and Exhibition West Africa 2024 held in Accra say adopting precast concrete methods allows for the production of concrete on site in a controlled environment, leading to more efficient construction processes. Here is the organizer for the conference, Dr. Holger Karut, speaking to journalists.
Well, we see a huge potential, especially in precast construction. Precast, in return to on-site construction, offers a way bigger quality, more speed of construction. The advantages of precast are simply said. You produce the elements in a factory-controlled environment. So you see exactly the tolerances. You know this piece of construction, this element will fit. So when it's brought to the construction site, you take it and you assemble it and that's it. And this is the way how the future of construction in Ghana should be. We will have one of the presentations here today. You should ideally design already in the beginning, having a precast structure in mind. Then you know where to put the columns, what possible distances are for the columns, the ceiling spans and so on. You will find all this information in the book. The book is quite expensive if you buy it.
Dr. Holger Karut is the organizer of the International Concrete Conference and Exhibition West Africa 2024, and then City Business News on Eyewitness News. The Business News on Eyewitness News is brought to you by GCB Bank PLC. GCB Personal Loan, make that big move and dream a reality. My name is Hawa Idrisu Mustafa. Up next is Point Blank.
Eyewitness News. Be there as it happens.
This is Point Blank on Eyewitness News. My name is Umaru Sandamadi. Tonight on Point Blank, we're talking about the Electricity Company of Ghana and the regulator of that sector, the Public Utilities Regulatory Commission, PURC. This morning, the PURC issued a statement in which it announced that sanctions have been imposed on board members of the Electricity Company of Ghana, and the reason is that they did not comply with certain directives that were given them by the regulator. This has been long in coming, actually. The PRC in the past gave orders to the power distributor, which orders have been defied. Key among the orders is to publish a load shedding timetable. We'll be hearing from former Energy Minister or former Power Minister Dr. Kwabena Donkor in a bit. But before then, let's listen to Mr. Ishmael Ejokumhini. He's a member of the Public Utilities Regulatory Commission, PURC. He spoke on the City Breakfast Show with Bernard Avle and explained the position of the PURC. Let's listen.
Okay, first and foremost, the PURC acted on advice from the legal department, and we were advised that there are legal precedents to what we are trying to do. The main rationale, and I think that is also contained in the order, you see, every cost incurred by ECG, once it's legitimate, would have to find its way back into the tariff. Okay? So if we find a company, let's say 10 million, and they pay as a fine, they can find a nice way of disguising that cost. And when they are submitting their, when they are asked to submit their request for tariffs, it can find its way there as an operating expense. All operating expenses are, once we allow it, they are supposed to be passed through the tariff. So the commission said that, okay, we're not going to do that, because if we did that, it can find its way back into the tariff. And we're not going to be able to control how it gets back into the tariff. So we were advised by the legal team that it's possible to attach the fine to the management and also the board. So that's the import of that side. We didn't want the whatever fine once paid to be reintroduced into the tariff. And two, we've been advised that as a legal precedent to what we are attempting to do.
Did the idea of going through a high court come up in the discussion? Because if you go to 32 of your act, it talks about enforcement of your decisions, and it's very explicit where it says that where the board, whether before or after an investigation, makes a decision or gives a direction requiring a person to do or desist from doing an act, and there's failure on the part of that person to comply with the direction or decision within a specified period or within a reasonable time, the commission may... So it's not shall, it says may, apply to the High Court for the enforcement of the decision or direction. So it appears the law is inviting you to use the court if your direction is not followed, which appears to be what the ECG has refused to do. I don't know whether that came up at all, and whether the issue of time and court process came up, for which reason you went the direct route.
Okay, so you also see that we all quote the relevant provisions of the Act that upon which we were imposing the fine. I think the fine was the next logical step for the Commission. We will get to that bridge if depending on how ECG responds to this latest order. But yes, we are aware of that provision, and I guess the court is the final arbiter when it comes to disputes. So we decided as a commission to impose this fine. And mind you, this is not going to be the first fine. That you recall that when the issue with the prepaid metering and people were not able to buy power, and with at least since I've been on the board, there are a number of fines that ECG have they paid. So I hope this time around too they will comply with the order. But if not, I believe the legal department will advise the commission appropriately.
When we read your decision, we notice you emphasize a lot on the 600 and something transformers. Are we to understand that the original reason ECG gave for the outages was overloaded transformers, for which you were holding them accountable? I'm asking this because when you read ECG's recent public announcements, they seem to be blaming power outage on Gridco taking power off certain bulk supply points. But I noticed that in your sort of your analysis and your judgment, you kept referring to the transformers. So just clarify for us, did the ECG give those overloaded transformers as the original basis for the power outages, for which you stuck to that throughout your judgment?
Yeah, so, Bernard, when you, according to our law, when you give wrong or false information to the commission, it's an offense, okay? We were all in this country when we heard the managing director of ECG saying that there were 630 transformers that were overloaded. It came to the regulator as a surprise because we are in constant touch with all the utilities that we regulate. So during our periodic monitoring and all the reports that ECG submits to the commission, they never mentioned that. So it came to the commission as a surprise. So when the managing director puts out this information, we immediately said, okay, please tell us where these transformers are, and so that we can go and double check. And if it's true that these transformers are overloaded, then let us know your plan for addressing the overload, in which case let us know your timetable for how you're going to manage that load deficiency, because if the transformers are overloaded and you're going to take down transformers, that planned outages, so you should be able to tell us. So we were just following up on an information that ECG itself had put into the public domain, which the regulator wasn't aware. So when we wrote to the ECG, if that wasn't the case, they could probably have said that that wasn't the case. But
so that's Ishmael Ejekumuhini. It's a long interview that he granted Bernard Kokwavle on the City Breakfast Show. I'll be playing more of that. But let me go on the phone lines and speak to Dr. Kwabena Donko. He is MP for Pru East, former Minister for Power. You're welcome to Point Blank, sir.
Thank you.
First of all, I am believing that this is the first time we are seeing a sanction as serious as the one that the PURC has imposed on a utility service provider like ECG in the statement that we are seeing today. Or is there in the past sanctions where PURC will be on a collision course with a utility service provider, forcing it to impose sanctions like the one it has done today?
Well, in terms of the quantum of the sanction, I'm not aware of any sanction of that magnitude. But in terms of regular sanctions, yes, a regulator must impose sanctions for breaches of the law.
But how about the part that the regulator decided to go outside the body corporate and deal with the persons behind the company, i.e. the board members, and asking them to be surcharged or surcharging them for the cost that's incurred in the name of the company? What do you make of that?
For me, that is extremely refreshing. Extremely refreshing because I also rank the State Enterprises Committee of Parliament, and good governance has been noticed more by its absence in a number of our state-owned enterprises. Board members do not take responsibility for decisions of the entities that they superintend over.
And so I am very excited about that. Again, it is important that whether Jubilee House or Flagstaff House, for the power centers to appreciate and understand that once you appoint a board, all decisions of government, etc., must go through the board. And board members must be able to defend sound commercial decisions. With this, I believe it's not going to be business as usual. And that is why I'm so excited about the decision to go beyond the veil. In commercial law, it is allowed. Indeed, the Companies Act, Act 92, makes provision for that. You can attach directors for some offenses.
But is a PRC sanction coming a little too late, or you think that it is appropriate considering all the warnings that were given prior?
Well, it's better late than never. And for me, the import of the PURC release is the need for the public service and public service providers to be factual. I can understand the managing director of ECG wanting to put the best foot of the company forward, trying, as some would say, a bit too much to defend ECG in the light of challenges that they are not, may not be in control. There was essentially a decision shortfall. There is no amount of coloring that can erase the fact that we have a generation shortfall. And therefore, it ECG, who are the contractors to the IPP. There are two major generators in Ghana, VRA and IPP. ECG is the major contracting party to the IPP. And so ECG was aware that there was a generation shortfall. But they tried too hard to protect a certain image that was inconsistent with the actuality, inconsistent with what Ghanaians were feeling. And I believe that is where PURC has come in to say that, look, in terms of the transformers, the transformer, very few of them were overloaded relatively. And of course, if you have 630 transformers as ECG put out being overloaded, assuming that was even factual, out of over 32,000, that could not have impacted on supply the way that we have experienced. So, for me, the critical thing is one, responsibility of board and board members for decisions of their organization. And two, the need to be factual and accurate to the Ghanaian people. Attempt at window dressing has led ECG to this.
Now that the sanctions have been imposed, does it mean we don't have to get our doomsday timetable, or we will still get that as well?
I believe it was imposed for breaches up to a particular point. Regulators constantly monitor, and therefore, depending on what the regulators see, they will still insist on a load management schedule. It is so important for regulatory bodies to be up and doing. If we have regulatory bodies doing their work effectively, the need for politicians, especially the ministers, to intervene in matters that ought to be operational will not even arise. Ministers are responsible for policy. Let regulatory bodies do their work and control the operations as set out by law. However, I believe the ECG board, if I were advising them, I would advise them appeal against the quantum of the sanction. PURC wanted a number of breaches and imposed penalty points. PURC has the power to lower
the number of penalty points. In any case, PUIC's decision can be appealed, moved to the PUIC itself, or even through the courts. I want to see that development of the ECG board appealing the decision, the quantum of the fine, the sanction, to the PUIC board.
Moving forward, we are yet to hear from the ECG. The minister himself has not spoken. What do you think should happen subsequent to this PURC directive?
Well, when a regulatory body issues a directive, it has to be complied with or appealed. I will advise that the minister stays out of this, and I don't think he intends getting involved. Let the regulatory bodies do their work.
All right. Thank you so much for speaking to us, sir.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you.
That's Dr. Kwabena Donkor, MP for Pru East and a former minister for PAS, speaking to us on the directive by the PURC sanctioning members of the board of the Electricity Company of Ghana. Let's go back to that interview that Mr. Ismael Ejikumhini granted Bernard Avila on the City Breakfast Show today. He is with the PURC. Listen.
They attempted, they gave us all the information. And we've actually spent time going to all the transformers, or at least the majority of the transformers, and it is turning out to be that those transformers are not overloaded. So if for any reason the problem is GRIDCO telling, because that's what GRIDCO itself said, that they give instructions and ECG is not complying with those directives, in a timeous manner. So sometimes the whole system is on the verge of collapsing and all of that. But ECG never denied the information that their MD put out.
All right. Ismael, that's correct. But the other question is, if GRIDCO is the one giving ECG information about possible outages, why shouldn't GRIDCO just give us a timetable? Because, for example, if you take power off a particular bulk supply point, we know that there are specific communities on that bulk supply point, which both GRIDCO and ECG know. So why should it be ECG's job to make that announcement? Once GRIDCO is taking power off the bulk supply point at, say, I don't know, what's the name of one? Whatever.
Achimota.
Or
Malam. Yeah.
Or Malam. We know the communities under Malam. So once the power is going to go off the bulk supply point, GRIDCO should be in a position to tell us, unless the amount of power coming to the supply point is just a little lower than regular, for which then there has to be management. We need to understand who's responsible. Is it ECG or GRIDCO? Or must they jointly issue the schedule?
You see, Bernard, it's a good question that you're asking, but I'm sure we are not new to this issue in this country, and we've always known. You know, between you and I don't. You know, you don't have any contract with GRIDCO. You, as a consumer of electricity, you don't have any direct contract. It's ECG buys the product from GRIDCO and supplies it. So, consistently, it's ECG who have to tell the public that, look, GRIDCO, which is the entity giving me power, said that they can only give me 70%. So, because of that, I think from today, tomorrow, these are the places where we may have to shut the thing down. We have our own issue with GRIDCO. But let's see GRIDCO this way. I mean, it so happened that GRIDCO happens to be the system operator. But elsewhere, you can have the transmission company is not necessarily a system operator. So somebody sits in the middle and sees the bigger picture and said, look, we need X amount of power, but if you look at the generation asset, it's only Y that is coming through. So we need to manage or deal with, a deficit of Z, otherwise the whole system will collapse. That has been what GRIDCO as a system operator has been doing and telling not just ECG, but NETCO as well. If some load will have to go off, normally because ECG, they are the entity, utility that has direct contact and contract with you and I. So yes, we can, but you see,
Let ECG tell the regulator that it's not my problem, it's not my fault, I am not the one. But you don't go and inform the public that this is the problem, and then when you put, we are put to test to prove it, it turned out not to be true. So I'm sure we can argue as to who should release the load shedding or load management timetable. But quite frankly, it's ECG who have to tell their customers that we don't have enough power, so we're going to take you out.
So that's Ismaili Jekumhini. He's a member of the Public Utilities Regulatory Commission as a commissioner, speaking to Bernard Avila on the City Breakfast Show. Earlier, you heard Dr. Kwabena Donkor, former Minister of Power. That would be it for Eyewitness News tonight. My name is Umaru Sanda Amadu. I did this with Hawa Idrisu. Production by Bevelyn London, Kwabena Wilson, and Sami Biafi. Technical support from Desmond Nyakun. New media support from Edwin Kwakofi. We return tomorrow at 17:30 GMT. Thank you for listening and have a good night.
We speak first. Reach our hotline on 0302-224959 and get interactive on Facebook, City 97.3 FM, and on Twitter at City 973.